Only the victim is alive and the murderers are not. It's a pity you didn't know when you started your game of murder that I was playing too.
It has been established that persons who have recently died have been returning to life and committing acts of murder.
Believe the ghosts?
First simply disappears, the other two died.
Hello, hello, my pretties. It's your host, Ashley Lana, welcoming you back to another episode. How is everyone doing? I'm doing fantastic. It's officially spring, according to the calendar, but according to Canada, it's probably just fool's spring yet again. But we have officially reached double digits in our weather, which is very nice. And the Canadian geese are back to harass the magpies in every back alley. Do you remember on a past episode that I mentioned that Edmonton, Canada has a strange spiritual cult leader who's been lurking around since the 90s? Well, update on this one. The Church of Integrated Philosophy, led by internationally self-appointed Messiah and Christ on Earth, John D. Ryder. Let's see if you remember this. Long story short, he sits on a stage under a soft light and stares that thousand-mile stare with cool blue eyes until the Lord touches him to speak to the congregation or some specific chosen member. Do you remember this guy? I mentioned him on, I don't remember what episode it was. I can only assume it was a cult episode. Well, this guy. So in 1999, basically, his wife confronted him during a public gathering regarding John being involved, very scandalous, with two daughters of a member who was donating to the church. So these girls would then go on to press charges. And one of them testified that John said that she would be defying him and therefore defying God and defying the truth if they didn't do stuff together. You know, cult leader 101. So fast forward to 2017. John publicly admitted to having a sexual relationship with his female church members because God gave him the calling to bless him. Anyways, a female member was found dead under strange circumstances. On January 21st of this year, 2023, 63-year-old John D. Ryder was arrested and charged with sexually assaulting four complainants in separate incidences occurring between 2017 and 2020. John D. Ryder claims that he is innocent and will, quote, vigorously contest these charges in a court of law. I just thought I would update you on that one because I kind of smelled that one. It was a little bit strange. I'll keep you updated as it progresses. Viva la Canada. Today's case examination is also staying in my home province of Alberta, Canada. And we Canadians, we love our poutine, we love our hockey, and we're polite, and we apologize and say sorry for everything. I apologize to mannequins if I bumped them in the store. But like everywhere else on the planet, we have our own batch of certified fruitcakes drizzled with maple syrup and Saskatoon berries. So with that being said, welcome to Lullaby. Last episode, we discussed the forgotten Asian Auschwitz, Unit 731, which was organized by General Surgeon Shiro Ishii of the Japanese military, where he performed monstrous tests on thousands of humans in the name of scientific, chemical, and biowarfare research. This week, Fear Cult, we are examining a case that happened in Medicine Hat, Alberta in 2006. My sources for this episode include Runaway Devil, written by Robert Remington and Sherry Zickelfoos, the CBC News, and the Medicine Hat local news archives. And I remember when this case hit the news, and once it became international, the world kind of thought it was a creepypasta urban legend. But let me make this very clear. This is no legend, and it happened basically in my backyard. So get comfortable, because sweet dreams are made of these. The following story contains graphic descriptions of depression, mental health, crimes against children, and murder. Please take into consideration that some topics may not be suitable for all listeners. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
I'm just
just so totally over my rents. Like, they think that they can control everything that I do.
No, but they can't fucking control you.
No, they can't. And I'm practically an adult, and they should mind their own fucking goddamn business. Like, you don't see me telling them who they can and can't hang out with. It's fucking stupid, Jeremy.
Yeah, and no matter what, I'm not gonna leave you.
Like, if I don't think you realize, like, if I can't see you, if my parents don't let me see you, then we can't be together and I have to dump you.
What? Why? What? Just because they...
Well, then maybe we should get rid of them. Did you ever think of that?
Get rid of them? Like, what do you mean, get rid of them?
You can just get rid of them. And cut their fucking throats in their sleep. So I think you could do it.
You think I could do it? I'd kill your fucking family if it meant that we could run away together.
See, it's a good idea. I'm so proud of you. It'd be so fucking good.
Really? Okay. Then we're gonna need a plan.
Then I guess I'll get to planning. This is the true story of Jasmine Richardson and Jeremy Steinke, the 300-year-old werewolf. Jeremy Allen Steinke was born on January 15, 1983, in Medicine Hat, Alberta, Canada. His mother, Jacqueline May, was an alcoholic who suffered from addiction to prescription drugs for her diagnosed depression and anxiety. She would often suffer panic attacks that would disrupt her daily routines. When Jeremy was born, he was diagnosed with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. FASDS is a group of conditions that occur in an infant exposed to alcohol prior to birth. This condition affects the physical development of both the central nervous system of the brain, which often leads to both behavior and learning disabilities. A child with FASD may suffer from poor coordination, hyperactive behavior, poor memory, speech and language delays, and even birth defects. There is no cure for fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, but early intervention can benefit a child substantially. Jacqueline had been married a total of 3 times, and all her husbands, including Jeremy's birth father, were physically and mentally abusive towards her and Jeremy. Jeremy's mother testified that her second husband would beat her son with a paint stick. Her third husband would slam Jeremy's head into the deep freeze. Jacqueline made this testimony in court, saying, quote, "Jeremy's dad started using the belt on him around 2 years old. He would sometimes pick Jeremy up by the ears and carry him to his room, or grab him by the ears and drag him to his bedroom." According to child welfare, the physical and mental abuse had caused Jeremy to develop childhood depression and traumatic stress that dangerously progressed as he aged. In grade 5, classmates remember frequent anger outbursts in class from Jeremy. Going into his early teens, Jeremy started taking prescription drugs for his depression and for diagnosed schizophrenia. In 1996, when Jeremy was 13 years old, he was diagnosed with hyperactivity and severe depression. He started inflicting pain on himself to avoid the mental pain. He frequently confessed to his mother that he wished he was dead and that he was never born. As Jeremy grew up, his mentality never changed. His biological father continued to abuse him, and all Jeremy wanted was an escape from his life in the trailer park. The instability and the substance abuse he'd seen at home had affected his educational performance as well. He struggled both with making friends and going to class. At 14 years old, he began attending Medicine Hat High School, and the other teenagers would bully him for his learning disabilities. Jeremy began smoking marijuana, taking psychedelics, and drinking heavily. And by the 10th grade, Jeremy had dropped out of school and was unemployed. Despite being bullied, Jeremy did become close friends with 2 boys, Grant Bolt and Jordan Atfield. Jordan was around 6 years younger than Jeremy, and he ran away from a foster home and needed a roommate. So Jeremy and Jordan shared a small place together in town. Together, they would attend concerts, drink, and hang out at the local mall. And in the summer of 2005, Jeremy began taking interest in the gothic subculture around town. Jeremy is bullied by his family and his classmates, and then he drops out of school in grade 10. And this is where we can see the traumatic childhood development in relation to his fetal alcohol syndrome really play a role in his behavior. Jeremy started making friends with teens who were younger than him, significantly, by almost 10 years. Jeremy is 22, 23 at this point, and he's hanging out at the local mall with 12 to 15-year-olds. So due to his fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, that impaired his learning abilities. According to documents and his mother's testimonies, Jeremy had the mental capacity of a 15-year-old teenager. Therefore, he got along better with underage teens. His mother, Jacqueline, defended this in court by saying, quote, "He got along better with people younger than him. They accepted him better. Kids his own age just bullied him," end quote. And it's safe to say that a lot of these kids were probably using him because he was old enough to drive and old enough to buy alcohol. I'ma just say it. So Jeremy is considered this alpha male of his pack of mall rats, the unofficial head of the gothic punk posse, according to his friends, and the group age varied from 12 to 23 years old. But what they all had in common was that they all felt rejected by society. And all these kids thought that Jeremy was a badass, and they also described him, though, as caring, sweet, loud, and funny. Okay, cool. Now we're gonna cue the X-Files theme song. Jeremy believed and convinced his younger friends that he was in fact a 300-year-old werewolf. He wore a vial of blood around his neck to assert dominance, and he claimed to enjoy drinking blood and to have consumed baked sugar cookies with his friend's blood on it. And then that there was so much blood in the cookies that they came out pink. A cool story, bro, but that's fucking gross. So whether or not Jeremy is lying and believes that he's, I don't know, a fucking 300-year-old werewolf, he loves the attention that this taboo behavior brings to him. And I wanted to read more about this behavior that Jeremy displayed, so I found an article titled What You Should Know About Attention-Seeking Behavior in Adults, written by Scott Frothingham and medically reviewed by Dr. Timothy J. Legg. In summation, Jeremy's mental health capacity is that of a 15-year-old, and he was abused by grown men his entire life. People in his class bullied him for being different. Now, the article that I read stated that attention-seeking behavior may be driven by low self-esteem and loneliness. And standing out as a gothic werewolf could have made Jeremy feel powerful and reassured that his self-worth was cool because younger teenagers found it cool when adults told him to basically grow up. Also, the article explains that sometimes attention-seeking behavior is a result of a cluster B personality disorder, such as histrionic, borderline, and narcissistic personality disorders. And again, it's important to note that my research for this case did not find any professional documents diagnosing Jeremy Steinke with any of those specific disorders. Jeremy Steinke was only clinically diagnosed with depression, fetal alcohol syndrome, and schizophrenia. That was all confirmed by psychiatrists. So the bottom line is that Jeremy's poor mental health was affecting him. And he started feeling validated and cool by spending time with underage girls, convincing them that he was a 300-year-old werewolf who drank blood and ate cookies baked with his friend's fucking circulatory system. Jeremy, at this time, is on multiple websites meeting others who are interested in the gothic lifestyle. And they would meet up at the mall and go to concerts, which actually sounds pretty cool. And on the website vampirefreaks.com, Jeremy would use the screen name Soul Eater. And he ends up meeting a 12-year-old girl with the screen name Runaway Devil, aka Jasmine Richardson, who would change his world forever. Jasmine Richardson was born on October 21st, 1993 in Medicine Hat, Alberta. Her parents, Mark and Deborah Richardson, had met at a substance abuse recovery program in 1990 and got married the following year, 1991. Both parents successfully completed rehabilitation and happily welcomed two children into their lives. Jasmine was the oldest, and her younger brother, Jacob. The middle-class family was very close and enjoyed spending evenings and weekends playing games together. Jasmine was a straight-A student who went to Catholic school and was considered popular. She enjoyed participating in the fine arts such as graphic design, film, video creation, and even photography. As Jasmine grew into her preteens, the ambitious 12-year-old began drastically changing her style. She'd seen a local group of gothic teenagers hanging out at the mall, and this piqued her interest. Soon after, Jasmine exchanged her schoolgirl uniform for mesh t-shirts, black makeup, and fishnet stockings. It's important to note that being interested in gothic subculture is relatively normal and healthy. The term gothic refers to an attitude and lifestyle that manifests in a specific type of dark music and fashion. The style can be described as one of sadness and depression, according to Everyday Health, but it is not always the case. Culture is one of self-expression and individuality. Unfortunately for Jasmine, she took a turn for the worst. Jasmine began showing the typical preteen hormonal changes. Her physical development had caused her to look around 15 years old, but her mood swings and sudden rejection towards her parents concerned them the most. Jasmine began throwing tantrums when she did not get her way, and she started avoiding her family completely. Her parents, Mark and Deborah, decided it was best for the family to go to counseling together to work through the changes. Despite their best efforts, Jasmine only got worse. It didn't take long before Jasmine and her new friends began hanging out at the mall together. In late 2005, Jasmine joined the social media platforms VampireFreaks.com and the Canadian platform Nexopia, which is very similar to MySpace, to meet fellow goths. She went by the screen name Runaway Devil. On her Nexopia page, Jasmine changed her age to 15 years old. Jasmine would post quotes from the loopy character the Mad Hatter from Alice in Wonderland about descending into madness and loving dark poetry. She listed her music taste as loud, and her favorites included Korn, Cradle of Filth, Marilyn Manson, Slipknot, Demon Hunter, and Hatebreed. At the bottom of her Nexopia page was one sentence, "Welcome to my tragic end." In the factual novel titled Runaway Devil, written by Canadian investigative journalist Sherry Zuckervoos, 12-year-old Jasmine was introduced to 23-year-old Jeremy on Valentine's Day in 2006 at the Medicine Hat Mall with friends, and the two immediately blossomed into a romance. Most accounts online claim that Jeremy and Jasmine met at a punk concert in 2006. However, friends of the teenager testified that they had been introduced at the Medicine Hat Mall. Little did she know that 3 days before Jeremy had met Jasmine, he attempted suicide. Jeremy felt a rush of life flow through his body when he met Jasmine, and he was excited to mean something important to someone else. The couple quickly legitimized their relationship and started going to rock concerts and local parties. When Jasmine and Jeremy were not together, their online relationship developed through multiple messages and photographs, where Jeremy convinced Jasmine that he truly was an immortal werewolf who was there to protect her. She transitioned into not caring about anyone else except for Jeremy. She stopped following her school's dress code and backtalked to her teachers. Jasmine started drawing demonic symbols on her body to upset her Catholic peers, and the teenager's demeaning attitude did not go unnoticed by her family. Jasmine's parents started paying closer attention to whom she was hanging out with. They discovered on their daughter's social media pages that she had been building an intense relationship with an older man with the screen name Soul Eater. Mark and Deborah, Jasmine's parents, immediately became concerned when they realized that Jeremy was 23 years old and their daughter was only 12. When Jasmine threw a tantrum, her parents grounded her. While she sat in her bedroom stewing her anger, she began privately emailing Jeremy on her computer, gushing over how much she missed his ancient powers and the romantic rendezvous. It didn't take long for Jasmine to start sneaking out of the house to spend nights with Jeremy. One event occurred when Jasmine had told her parents that she was going to a rock concert in town with her friend, neglecting to inform them that Jeremy would be escorting her as well. After the show, Jeremy had passionately kissed Jasmine up against a chain-link fence. According to Jasmine's friend, who was 13 years old at the time, Jasmine's parents drove up and seen their daughter making out with a grown man that she was forbade to see. Her parents had already begun counseling for Jasmine's behavior, and grounding was clearly not working. They removed her computer from her bedroom in hopes that no contact would ever be made again. Jasmine's friends recalled Jasmine complaining about not being able to see Jeremy and wanting to get rid of her parents, threatening to have them killed. Although concerned with Jasmine's statements, they were confident that she was simply just acting tough. Since dating Jeremy, Jasmine had replaced a lot of her school friends with her 23-year-old boyfriend. Jasmine was still sending private emails to Jeremy from the family computer and calling him on the home phone. Jasmine was fed up and sent a direct message to Jeremy saying, quote, "I have this plan. It begins with me killing them and ends with me leaving with you." One night, Jasmine was able to secretly call Jeremy. What the couple did not know was that Jeremy's roommate, Jordan Atfield, had overheard the entire phone call. Afterwards, Jeremy approached Jordan and asked him if he would help him murder his girlfriend's parents. Jordan ignored the question, assuming it was just typical of Jeremy being ridiculous. It wasn't uncommon for Jeremy to have outbursts when he was riled up, and he would threaten others. Therefore, none of his friends ever took him seriously. On March 13, 2006, Jeremy DM'd Jasmine's Runaway Devil account saying, quote, "You're a sight for sore eyes, and I miss you more than killing people. Can we get together and kill people?" The following week, Jeremy posted that he was annoyed with Jasmine's parents and that they should get with the program and realize that the times are changing and they can't stop it.
"My lover's rents are totally unfair. They say that they really care. They don't know what's going on. They just assume. As their greed continues to consume. She is slowly going insane. She continues to thank me that I came into her life to help her out. And to stop what they keep trying to shout. It's all total bullshit. Their throats I want to slit. They will regret the shit that they have done. Especially when I see to it that they are gone. They shall pay for their insolence. Finally, there shall be silence. blood shall be payment.
A week before the murder, Jeremy was hanging out with his childhood friend, Grant Bolt. The two were smoking marijuana and having a few beers. Grant knew that Jeremy had been dating a girl, but never actually met Jasmine. He was only aware that his friend was madly in love with her. Grant explained that once Jeremy started dating Jasmine, he'd become distant and quiet. His style became even darker, and his attitude far more morbid. It was apparent to everyone that Jeremy wanted to do everything in his power to keep his new girlfriend. Grant would later testify in court that on that night, Jeremy, out of the blue, asked him if he would help commit first-degree murder.
Man, how far would you go for love?
Wow, that's a loaded question this time of the day. Oh shit, you're serious.
You don't even know what it's like, man. I'm in so much shit right now, man. Like, I need advice. I need help.
All
right.
I mean, all the years I've known you, I can definitely tell something is bothering you. You're always stressed out anyway, right?
So I'm all out of options, man. Like, I pretty much, where it's at right now is that I need to kill Jasmine's parents.
I'm sorry, you're going to kill Jasmine's parents? To off them?
To off them. To kill them. Jasmine's pretty much going to break up with me unless I do.
I mean, it's a little drastic on her end, isn't it? I mean, fuck.
Yeah, but I fucking love her, man. And this is, like, the one thing that's going to keep us from being together, and I'm not having it, dude. Like, I need to fucking kill her parents.
Okay, so you're expecting me to believe that you're gonna go and kill your girlfriend's parents?
Yeah, and I'm probably gonna need your help.
What, to kill her parents? Wait, you want me to just hold the trunk where you put them in,
or something like that? Yeah, you need to. Yeah, I'm gonna need your fucking help.
No, we're not doing that, and you're fucking insane. We are not doing that.
Well, then we're not gonna be able to fucking be together.
Okay, well, you know what? That sounds like a you and Jasmine problem. You can go fuck yourself. You think I'm gonna go kill her parents so you can go off and marry her? No.
But I fucking love her.
Great, you love her. Fantastic. So, you know, you can go off, go get married to her, go fuck yourself. And you know what? Why don't you go roll your own fucking joints for good measure?
Earlier in the day on April 22, 2006, Jeremy sat with his friends and watched the 1994 Quentin Tarantino film Natural Born Killers. The story follows two traumatized childhood abuse victims turned into a serial killer couple, Mickey and Mallory. The lovers are on the run and have become a media sensation following their crimes. In the film, the boyfriend, Mickey, played by Woody Harrelson, murders his girlfriend Mallory's parents, but spares the life of Mallory's little brother. Jeremy described the film as true romance. During the movie, Jeremy had consumed an entire case of beer with wine and vodka. Jeremy claimed that he snorted cocaine and even took an ecstasy pill. A friend of Jeremy's, a 15-year-old girl protected by the Youth Criminal Justice Act, described Jeremy's behavior as, quote, angry and frustrated. In court, the girl testified that she concluded Jeremy was going to kill his girlfriend's parents. Jeremy expressed that if everyone could talk Jasmine out of the murder, then he would not go through with it. Deeply concerned, the group of friends called Jasmine, but it was unsuccessful. Later in court, defense lawyer Tim Foster attempted to discredit certain Crown witnesses, claiming that they were unreliable and unstable. The 15-year-old girl stated that it was Jasmine who was behind the murder plot, and even though she was drinking that night, she was sober enough to recall everything. Jeremy was going to follow through with his girlfriend's plans. He put on a black ski mask and concealed two knives in his jacket. He drove to Jasmine's home, and the plan was to help break her out and go on the run. Jeremy threw pine cones at Jasmine's window to let her know to go down into the basement where they could meet. Jeremy slid into the basement through a small window, and Jasmine's mother, 48-year-old Deborah Richardson, heard someone in her home and went downstairs to investigate. As Deborah flicked on the lights, Jeremy lunged at the woman and began viciously stabbing her body with a knife. In total, Deborah Richardson was stabbed 12 times. It did not take long for Jasmine's father, 42-year-old Mark Richardson, to rush to the screams of his wife. Wielding a screwdriver, Mark attempted to fight off the masked intruder, but Jeremy would ultimately overpower the man and stab him 24 times. As Mark was lying on the floor dying, he asked the intruder, "Why?" Jeremy simply replied, "It's what your daughter wanted." Meanwhile, upstairs in the Richardson home, Jasmine was with her younger brother in his room. Jasmine had attempted to suffocate Jacob, but was unsuccessful, and ended up slitting the child's throat with a knife while Jeremy watched from the doorway. According to Jasmine, she did not want her brother to be left an orphan and decided upon a mercy killing. Jeremy would go on later to explain that killing Jacob was not part of the original plan. It was Jasmine who decided her brother must die as well. Jeremy stated he did not kill 8-year-old Jacob Richardson, but he did not stop Jasmine when she cut his throat. Jasmine would later testify in court that she watched her brother gargle his own blood to death. Rejoicing in their crimes, the couple proceeded to engage in intercourse. The next day, on April 23, 2006, Jeremy and Jasmine arrived at a house party hosted by Taylor Randlesums, who was not a close friend of the couple. Grant Bolt had been at the party and had seen Jeremy with a girl who he never met before, but only could assume that it was his girlfriend Jasmine. Grant told the court, quote, "You could tell they were boyfriend and girlfriend. They were kissing, cuddling, all that sort of thing." The two had been eating burgers from a fast food restaurant. Both appeared calm and relaxed. And Grant explained that Jeremy had a bloody black eye that did not go unnoticed. When Grant approached the couple, Jeremy started explaining that he had gone through with his plans and murdered Jasmine's parents. Grant was uncomfortable by how Jasmine just sat next to Jeremy as he detailed the crime, saying, quote, "It was kind of strange. She just sat there calmly and ate her burger, like nothing was going on." Other witnesses at the party overheard Jeremy brag about his dangerous behavior and the murders with no shame of what had happened. Jasmine would go on to say that she loved him so much, it would bring them closer together. On April 23rd, the bodies of Mark and Deborah Richardson were discovered by an 8-year-old neighborhood boy who was friends with Jacob. He had come over to play with Jacob, but when no one answered the door, his curiosity made him peek through the windows. Upon looking into the basement window, he seen the bodies of Mark and Deborah on a blood-soaked floor. The young child immediately ran to tell his parents, and his mother called the police. When the police arrived at the crime scene, Mark and Deborah's bodies were in the basement, while their youngest child, Jacob, was found in his bed, covered in blood with his stuffed animals. The officers noticed family photographs with Jasmine, but realized that she was nowhere to be found. They were worried that she was abducted and possibly murdered at a second location. The officers had discovered an image drawn by Jasmine herself of the family home burning down, with everyone inside except Jasmine. Later that evening, when the murder surfaced on the news, many of Jeremy's friends had contacted the police, informing detectives of their prime suspects. Detectives first believed that Jasmine had been abducted, but this development revealed that she too was responsible. Meanwhile, Jasmine and Jeremy had already packed up and left Medicine Hat, with the plan of leaving Alberta to go to the neighboring eastern province of Saskatchewan. The following day, Jasmine and Jeremy were arrested in a parking lot in the town of Leader, Saskatchewan. During a 3-hour drive to a psychiatric facility in Calgary, Alberta, Jeremy had bragged about his crimes to an undercover officer named Corey Booth, who was posing as a fellow prisoner. On the audio tape, Jeremy can be heard describing how he was confronted by Deborah Richardson in the basement, and he stabbed her. When she screamed, her husband Mark rushed downstairs and attacked him with a screwdriver, but missed. Jeremy smirked as he recalled Mark lying on the floor asking, "Why?" As Jeremy continued, he explained that he watched his girlfriend Jasmine cut her brother's throat upstairs. Jeremy dismissed Jasmine's claims that she did not kill her brother Jacob, and that she was willingly participating in the crimes, saying, quote, "It didn't bother her at all either. She didn't cry or anything. In fact, the next day when we were on the road, she was laughing. She was laughing about it too. She's got a few screws loose." Jeremy told the officer that the only regret was failing to get away scot-free, that if he could do it again, there's a bunch of things he would have done differently, saying, quote, "Instead of telling anyone, I would have kept it all hush as possible. The biggest fuck up was telling people. If nobody got told, then nobody would have slipped the information." Following their arrest, Jeremy and Jasmine agreed to get married in prison through multiple love letters. Their romantic plans, however, were short-lived when they both began pinning the blame on each other for the murder of 8-year-old Tyler Jacob Richardson. When Jasmine was first interviewed by detectives, she admitted that she was depressed because her parents did not let her have a relationship with Jeremy. She admitted to ranting about her parents and threatening to hurt them, but that was just, quote, "stupid talk." In her first statement, Jasmine claimed that she had come home and discovered the bodies of her murdered family, and that she knew it was Jeremy who did it. In another statement, Jasmine admitted to being home at the time of the murders and was next to her brother Jacob when Jeremy had killed him. But then she admitted to ending Jacob's life herself by cutting his throat on his bed next to his toys, because she did not want to leave him as an orphan. In June 2007, Jasmine Richardson, now 14 years old, was convicted of 3 counts of first-degree murder, where she pled not guilty. In July of the following month, Jasmine Richardson was found guilty on all counts of first-degree murder. Since she was only 12 years old at the time of the murders, Jasmine could not be tried as an adult, and she was given the maximum sentence of 10 years in prison. Jasmine was credited 18 months' time served, and was to spend 4 of the 10 years in a psychiatric facility. If Jasmine didn't break the law for 5 years after her sentence, her record would be expunged. Jeremy Steinke's trial began in 2008. Jeremy took full responsibility for his crimes and pled that he was influenced by Jasmine's romance, drugs, and alcohol. He broke down crying when describing the murder of 8-year-old Jacob Richardson, explaining that he watched as Jasmine killed him and he didn't stop her. The trial lasted 2.5 weeks, and 25-year-old Jeremy Steinke was charged with 3 counts of first-degree murder without parole for a minimum of 25 years. In 2011, Jeremy filed an appeal due to unreasonable verdict, asking for a new trial to be heard by a judge alone, but abandoned the conviction in 2012. Jeremy Steinke has changed his name to Jackson May and is still currently serving 3 concurrent life sentences. Jasmine. So, she ended up getting released in 2016, but since 2010, she had been serving in open custody at the Edmonton, Alberta Hospital Intensive Rehabilitation Unit. And this is permitted basically to allow her to go on escorted trips to the mall, to the bank, therapy sessions, and it's to slowly integrate her back into society for 2016 at the age of 22 years old. And this is known as Intensive Rehabilitative Custody and Supervision Order, or IRCS. According to the Federal Department of Justice, serious violent offenders, even who may suffer mental or psychological disorders, are available to partake in IRCS. And this is how Jasmine was able to serve 4 years of her sentence in reintegration into society. Over this period of time, Jasmine, she attended all these sessions, and according to her files, Jasmine Richardson has received a good review for being described as a poster child for rehabilitation. Meanwhile, she also went to university and she graduated from the Mount Royal University in Calgary in 2015. And since her release in May 2016, her criminal record has been wiped clean of her crimes and she has changed her name, obviously, for the protection. And she did not return to Medicine Hat, deeming that it would have been, quote, too traumatic. So when it comes to how the community reacted to Jasmine being released in 2016, it's got some pretty mixed Rotten Tomatoes, all right? Some think that she should not be forgiven, while others believe she was young enough at the time of the crimes to be rehabilitated and therefore deserves forgiveness. And it's currently 2023, which would make Jasmine 29 years old today. Oh my God. Wow, man. It kind of just hit me. That's really close to my age. So just at 12 years old, she committed these crimes. And now she's roughly, well, my age now. So, like, what was I doing at 12 years old? Sorry to turn this around on me for a second, but I just want to try and put myself in that position. What the fuck was I doing at 12 years old? I was probably racing home to watch Lizzie McGuire and That's So Raven. Let me tell you, I wasn't crushing over some 23-year-old man who identified as a 300-year-old werewolf to defend his pedophilic age gap. But if you really want to split hairs at 300 years old, I mean, everybody is underage to Jeremy, so. But at that, anyways, Fear Cult, what were you doing when you were 12 years old? And if you were plotting the murder of your parents, shame on you, and hopefully you did not go through with it. And if you did go through with it, shame on you. Don't listen to my podcast and get some therapy. So it's important to note that Jasmine had a normal upbringing. She had a loving family. She was basically just, a spoiled fucking brat who started to rebel. And her parents even took her to family counseling. They didn't even just ship her away to do it on her own. They're like, look, Jasmine, we love you. We want you to have a better life. We're going to go with you and try to help you. We're not trying to control you to make you unhappy. We just don't think it's appropriate for you to be 12 years old and having sex with a 23-year-old man. And then Jasmine thinks that it's her God-given right to just, I should be able to do what I want. I'm 12 years old. And manipulate her very unstable boyfriend to go through with the murders. So when it came down to it, experts concluded that it's difficult to say whether Jasmine Richardson has been truly rehabilitated, despite her low risk to reoffend. She has shown significant remorse for her crimes, I should fucking hope so, and criminal justice professor Mark Totten at the Humber College in Toronto, who also wrote the book When Children Kill, he said, quote, "We've got a young woman here who at the age of 12 was diagnosed with oppositional defiance disorder and conduct disorder. These are two very serious disorders. We simply don't know. We're going to have this conversation maybe 5 or 10 years down the road to see if this young woman is truly capable of maintaining the apparent positive changes she's made to date." End quote. Now, after the announcement of Jasmine's release, Queen's Bench Justice Scott Brooker told Jasmine, "I think your parents and brother would be proud of you. Clearly, you cannot undo the past. You can only live each day with the knowledge you can control how you behave and what you do each day." And this is a really good thing to say to Jasmine, because she basically spent a majority of her educational years in a psychiatric facility for her crimes. And yes, she cannot take back what she did, and she better be remorseful for it, because it was very selfish of her to think that she had basically the ability to do what she did, and now she's free. Jasmine's defense attorney, Catherine Bayek, stated that Jasmine has been dedicated to the process and hopes that Jasmine is safe with no backlash from the community. Inspector Brent Sekondiak, who was one of the first to respond to the murder scene back on April 23, 2006, in an interview with the CBC News, he commented on the release of Jasmine Richardson, saying, quote, "My biggest fear is that she hasn't been rehabilitated, that she tricked those in the system, and that she hasn't moved forward. I hope that she has truly taken the responsibility for this and is able to move forward." That is the true story of Jasmine Richardson and Jeremy Steinke. And those two were just an attention-seeking dumpster fire, if I can say so myself. I want to thank Tyler and Eric from the Team TNA podcast for their performance in this episode's dramatizations. I had to mute my mic when they recorded because those two were feeling it. I was like, "Eric, convince Tyler that you need him to kill your girlfriend's parents." And Tyler, before we even hit record, he's like, "Oh, fuck that." It was always good. I love recording with them. They're fantastic.
There'll be more, many more. They're coming for me now. And then they'll come for you.
Back on our never-ending quest to find a truly scary movie, I am recommending the 1993 thriller drama Fear, starring Mark Wahlberg and Reese Witherspoon. The story follows a 16-year-old girl who falls in love with a 23-year-old man who turns out to be a violent psychopath. I love this movie. Now I tried to scare you, now you try to scare me. Send me all your horror movie recommendations. I love getting them. I have a list building up again. Thank you. Follow Lullaby on Instagram at Lullaby the Fear Podcast, and thank you so much for listening to this week's Lullaby. Sweet dreams. Lights out.